Well, thank you all for your patience and for coming back after, I hope, an adequate break. It's really a lot of fun to hear Ernie expound on a subject that he really knows well, and I think we're all grateful for that. Then we want to thank the White Group for putting out quite a spread today. Thank you all. White Smoke, White Group. The Black Group will be the one that will be up next week. And Liz tells me that this is a special indulgence week. You get a plenary indulgence. If you haven't brought anything, and you should have in the course of... then you bring it next week, and all is forgiven. It's just, it's a miracle. Now, is there anything else that I'm forgetting? I don't think so. Okay. Ernie, why don't you come on back, and we have questions available at that microphone, please, or comments. Use that. Thanks so much.
One thing I forgot to mention, sorry, is that if you're interested in more of Teilhard, I'm putting together a workshop through Stillpoint. It'll be on July 6th at Goleta Presbyterian Church. And it's going to be my attempt to have a dialogical meditation and presentations on Teilhard de Chardin and my really most important teacher, Ramon Panikkar. There's information about that workshop on the table. And if you are interested, I'd encourage you to let us know. Pretty soon, we're going to limit that one to 20 participants so there can be a lot of discussion at that time. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for your presentation. I was intrigued in your presentation about the exponential graph of growing consciousness and how it similarly looks to the exponential graph of what's called the singularity of computers growing in intelligence with the human brain, and wonder if that's part of our evolution towards whatever you might be calling consciousness and human evolution.
Thank you. That's credited mainly to Ray Kurzweil these days. He's got a book called The Singularity. In my Teilhardian take on that particular singularity, I would consider that to be an example of tangential energy, which is, remember, the physical complexity. And even including wiring us up with computers would, I think, still be an example of tangential energy. And so that in itself would not be the kind of culmination that Teilhard is talking about. That tangential energy increase in complexity could be a part of pushing us even more toward the next leap in radial energy, center to center. So that the tangential energy, or rather the singularity as described by Kurzweil, I think has to do mainly with mind-to-mind. And with the radial energy, we're really groping towards a way of being together heart-to-heart, spirit-to-spirit. So possibly that the singularity as an example of tangential complexity and might be part of helping to usher in, might not, who knows, might be part of helping to usher in an actual transformation, the next stage of radial energy, which is what we're really looking for. The situation that's facing the world today, we probably won't only think our way out of it, by any means, but we very much need to feel our way out of it, which means finding each other. One of my axioms or observations is that we should have been to the stars by now. And the reason we're not is because we keep separating ourselves. What we're capable of as a species is just so much more than what we've accomplished. And we've got to cut that out. By the way, I can't remember who was the first person who prepaid for a book. I do have the one copy that I showed earlier, so if whoever gets over to the table that's already paid, we'll give you this one. Alice, hi.
In response to this question, I'm wondering if they're both the same. We're not talking about two different things. We're talking about two different aspects of the same thing. So who's doing the seeing of what's happening with computers? or what's happening with the planets or the galaxies moving further and further away from each other. It's all the same thing. I feel like what science is, it's just holding up what's happening inside.
You mean so, holding up as in supporting or holding back?
No, it's showing us. We're seeing it. Okay, we're actually able to see what's happening today. So if we're seeing that the planets are moving further and further away from each other at greater and greater speed, who's doing the seeing? To whom is that happening? And if we're simply seeing an inner dimension of ourselves, then we're participating in this, and then we can respond to it. So if this is what we're seeing in the computer world, who's doing that seeing? Is it really happening in the computer world, or is it something that's happening inside here, and we're participating in it, and therefore that's how we bring them together? Something like that.
Something like that.
Okay.
Again, tangential and radial, that important distinction in Teilhard's thought. Tangential energy, we're making huge strides on the level of the physical, new products coming out every few seconds that you really have to have in order to have a good life. It's rare to have, I can't think of one instance, to have a product come along that really transforms us in who we are. That kind of product is each other. And possibly related to what you just said, Alice, my own core mystical experience is when I reflect on the fact that whatever the universe is made of, I'm made of the same stuff. And yet somehow here I am able to think about and experience and feel the universe. That just blows my mind. And that really is the core of my experience of God. I downloaded recently a report called Origin and Evolution of Earth, Research Questions for a Changing Planet. And it's put out by the National Academies of Science, and it's the Earth Science Academy within that. And I was intrigued, as always, to note that in the set of research questions that they're proposing, consciousness is never mentioned, not even once. And here's a key question here. They want to explore, how are Earth processes controlled by material properties? So wonderful. Important question. But we define out in our science, in this kind of science, as much as I respect this kind of science, we define out consciousness. It's considered an epiphenomenon. And experience, reports of experience are just suspect because you cannot pin them down and so forth. Ken Wilber and others talk about that in terms of first quadrant, second quadrant. First quadrant being inner experience as experienced and then as explored from that point of view. Second quadrant being inner experience as seen from the outside. Somebody studying your brain or doing an MRI on you or something. Some scientists say that that's all there is. And they're going to ignore anything that you say about your experiences as they're studying your brain. Because the only thing that's really real is the... Anyway, you get the point. I think it was Carter Phipps, I'm not positive, who wrote in an article a couple of years ago. He had been doing a circuit of conferences on consciousness. And in one of them, which was a conference mainly of materialist scientists, he was talking with one of the presenters in the lobby during a break. And this presenter, a neuroscientist, was insisting that there's no such thing as mind. There's no such thing as consciousness. There's no such thing as free will. And Carter Phipps, in his article, says, now when I'm face-to-face with somebody who's telling me that he has absolutely no conscious control over his actions, my first impulse is to call security. More?
Your whole presentation reminded me of a book I read long ago. Probably written in the 1920s, I think. Arthur C. Clarke was touching on this in his fiction. And I remember reading Childhood's End, and it moved me deeply because I felt the truth in it, where all the adults are left behind because they're still on the tangential level, and it's the children who have reached into the radio level, and they gradually leave, all of them. And there are no children left because they have moved on, and the rest of the adults, people like us, have stayed behind. and not accepted what the children took for granted as part of their movement, their evolution. I loved that book. I'm going to find it.
Hopefully people like us are not people like you just described. I was a member of the Phenomenon of Man Project back when that book first came out. It was in the 60s or 70s. And I remember that we in the group were pretty excited about it because it seemed to be so, in a novel form, so paralleling what Taird was talking about. And there was a really intriguing comment by Arthur C. Clarke at the very beginning of the book. Never figured this one out. It said, the opinions or the positions presented in this book are not those of the author. You may also recall that Arthur Clarke was one of the screenwriters for 2001, A Space Odyssey. Yep.
Well, thanks for your great and unifying talk today. I don't know how to phrase this thought into a question, but I'm struck by the fact that you are a Buddhist attending Goleta Presbyterian Church. I'd just like to hear more about that. Maybe if you can wind in some interfaith thoughts for us about unity.
The workshop in July, by the way, is called The Interspiritual Journey, Being a Person of Faith in a World of Faiths. As Tom said in the introduction, I was brought up Catholic, and the first shaking of my Catholic faith was back during whatever year it was that the message that had been left by Mary with the three children of Fatima was supposed to be read to the world. I was in Catholic school at a time that we were really focused on that. I vividly remember the whole school being taken to the Catalina Theater in Tucson, Arizona, to see The Miracle of Our Lady of Fatima, the movie. And then we were told about this message that was going to be coming. And then that year came and that year went, and the first class meeting of the new year, I asked, "Sister, what about that message?" And the answer was, "Don't ask about that." And that was not very satisfying. Because I was... This is one insight that helps me understand fundamentalists these days. I recently watched again with Allison The Miracle of Our Lady of Fatima, and it brought back to me vividly how when I was a kid, all of that was true. In fact, it was so true that I didn't even think about it being true or not. It was just the way things are. And that certainty and that complete, naive, really was, faith. I have to remember back to that in myself now when I try to have conversations with friends my age or younger who are, say, fundamentalist Christians or fundamentalist anythings. I understand, or at least I can remember, that grasp, that searching for certainty, and the fear that unspokenly comes with it of having your boundaries challenged. So my boundary was challenged first by that incident. Also, when I was a kid, my dad tells me that when I was in about third grade, my late dad told me that he came to pick me up from school one day at St. Ambrose School, and I was sitting on the curb crying, he said, and he asked what was wrong. And I said, "Well, Father had just been telling us that day about God knowing from before you're born whether you're going to go to heaven or hell." And I couldn't accept that. So Presbyterian was the last thing I ever expected to find myself. Fortunately, they don't really insist much. I should say we now, because I've been one 25 years. Don't really insist much on that predestination clause anymore, which I couldn't accept as a kid, can't accept now. During that time, that was the 60s, I had moved to Los Angeles from Arizona, which is from Tucson, which was comparatively at that time a relatively insular environment to be brought up in. Moved to Los Angeles, and my first marriage fell apart during that time. I was not a part of any community, and my only exposure to Christianity at the time was television Christianity, and it was the time of the Vietnam War, and all of the warmongering I heard in the mouths of self-professed Christians made me go through a long period where I self-identified as not Christian. I'm not one of those. It was during that time, because I still had my spiritual longings, that I discovered, as so many people did during the 60s, meditation, contemplation. And some friends introduced me to the International Buddhist Meditation Center in Los Angeles, convened by Dr. Thich Thien Nhat, a little bitty fellow about that size, who has since passed on. But he was, it was an inter-Buddhist denominational Buddhist center, so learned quite a bit. And I really liked the amount of energy and focus that Buddhism put on the internal, the inner journey, which had not been part of my Christian upbringing, really. There are mystical resources within Christianity, of course, but I had not been exposed to them, and I really wanted this direct kind of experience of in touch with the infinite, the divine, whatever it's called. Buddhism does not say the divine, that's why I'm hesitant there. So I was Buddhist for a while. I still call myself a Christian Buddhist, but I need to be somewhat careful where I call myself that. moved to Los Angeles, from Los Angeles to Santa Barbara in 1974 to pursue religious studies. I had been working in computers at the time in L.A., and my wife at the time and I had found out about a program in religious studies at Cal State Northridge. So I was working daytimes and nighttimes, went to school and got a B.A. in religious studies, and got really interested in doing graduate work, and found out about the program up here, and came up here to do that. And I was going to study sociology of religion with Thomas O'Day, and in, I think, my first quarter being at UCSB, Thomas O'Day became very, very ill, died not too long after that. So his seminar, of which I was a part, was taken over by Ramon Panikkar. And I was familiar only with the name Panikkar, and I was only familiar with it because he was listed as one of the International Advisory Board members of the Teilhard Foundation. So I was kind of enthused to meet him. And he took on the seminar in sociology of religion, but we went in a whole different direction. And I then participated in Panikkar's seminars for 5 years, cross-cultural religious anthropology. In case you've not heard of him, Ramon was a Catholic priest. He was a Hindu holy man. He called himself an atheist, a Buddhist, a number of things. And it's real easy to call yourself all these things, but to be recognized as such is something quite else. And the Catholic Church recognized him still as a Catholic priest. Hindu community recognized himself as a holy man. His father was an Indian prince of some kind, Hindu, and his mother was a Spanish Catholic. So he was born into this need for cross-cultural dialogue. And I still think that his body of work is the most important contribution in the world to that effort toward cross-cultural dialogue. Unfortunately, it's all but inaccessible. Unless you're in a seminar with him for 5 years, his books are really hard to read. So one of my goals still in life is to try to make Panikkar's thought and vision more accessible. But because he was able to be all those apparently contradictory things, and because he supported the ability to be that so beautifully, philosophically, spiritually, that's what made me free to rediscover my Christian upbringing. I had been taught in Catholic school that once you're baptized Catholic, it leaves a permanent mark, an indelible mark on your soul. That turned out to be true. You probably recognize that if you're Catholic or have been Catholic. So I was able to come back to my Christian roots without giving up anything that I had learned that was of importance to me. When I first met Allison and when we first started going out, I was in that phase where I was considering myself specifically not Christian. And the first time we had a conversation about religion, Allison said Christian, and I kind of winced without saying anything about it, though. And then she invited me to come to her Goleta Presbyterian Church, and I really winced because my view of Presbyterians was self-righteous, small-minded, and mean. But then I went to Goleta Pres, met this warm, open, educated, interesting and interested group of people. So I've been there for 25 years now. I'm I'm finishing my fourth term on session soon. So that's my response to a question about where have you been.
You spoke about our need for unity and love and the Omega Point. But as I look at our country today, it seems like we're more and more polarized. So is there a cusp of uncertainty here? Or we might go one way or the other? Or how do you feel about how we can go down the right track best?
As Hayward said, and I quoted, our best guarantee that such a thing is possible, unity, is that we ourselves consider it to be vitally necessary. And another way of saying that is that there's no God miracle that's going to do it for us. Panikkar's way of saying that was, he used to say that we, humanity, are now infallible. Not that we cannot make a mistake, because we can, but infallible in the sense that nobody's going to overrule us. It is up to us. And for me, I feel like I'm an intersection between Teilhard and Panikkar. I never met Teilhard, but I did study for 5 years with Panikkar. And Panikkar, to me, points the way to a possibility of a human future. Teilhard kind of gives the vision that there can be a human future. Panikkar, for me, is one who really points the way toward how to do that. And that's by discovering each other. And that takes, as I said earlier too, that takes Teilhard's Omega Point and changes it from a little tiny point in time to a long piece of the evolutionary process. And when something so deep and fundamentally new is happening in the world, it's really not at all surprising how much fear comes out of it, as boundaries and definitions and everything are up for grabs. And if it were only, say, the Episcopal or the Presbyterian or the one or another church that was experiencing that, it would be one thing. But it seems like wherever we look in the world, politically, nationally, religiously, that's happening. And my only optimistic take on that is that that's a really, really powerful sign that something really deep is trying to happen. But it's without guarantees, except that we consider it to be absolutely necessary, and then make it happen.
Yeah, thank you, Ernie. I wanted to mention one quick thing, which is we're going to do our best, as we always do in Word and Life, for our final closing so-called liturgy, to keep it as broad as possible. We're certainly not, this is not a Catholic thing, just I needed to mention that. So John helps to put it together, but believe me, it's a celebration of our unity and diversity. And then I wanted to ask you, what about the 800-pound gorilla that's sitting over in the closet, i.e. the nuclear weapons that we have? Is there any, do you see any, I mean, I feel a lot of will on the part of all my brothers and sisters in humanity. We all have a will to do something to reduce or eliminate these things. But there is this inertia and there is this out of sight, out of mind problem that we humans have, that we just, if we don't see it every day, we don't think about it every day, we never mobilize. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I have the same fears that you probably have about nuclear weapons. An equally weighty gorilla is population. And that's dangerous to talk about in some places. I mean, the Catholic Church does not want that talked about. Yeah. And in the countries where it's most powerful, it does not want that talked about. But that's as serious as nuclear weapons, although the catastrophe would be slow motion instead of all at once with that. Quote one thing that the Dalai Lama pointed out in an interview not too long ago, that if we just watch the media every day, we can get really, really depressed, and more than depressed. And he points out that all that bad stuff that's reported on in the media, that's news. Oh, it's reported on because it's news. Most people are not like the terrible stuff that we see happening. And therefore, it's not interesting. If you have a lot of good people, good person, good person, good person, all going about their lives as best they can and trying to love one another, it doesn't make news. I find that important to remember. because it's easy for me to get buried in something close to despair. And as you mentioned in my bio, the fact that we have 11 grandchildren makes it, does not guarantee a future, but it guarantees that I have to resist despair, which again brings no guarantee, but at least it brings an ongoing commitment to look for the possible.
Well, it's just about noon, and I would like to thank you very much for an exquisitely prepared presentation.
Thank you very much.